Okay, just advising everybody that this call is being recorded and it's a meeting of the GNSO Council and we have a number of observers that have been involved in the new GTLD policy work and we also have Adrian Canderas who will be replacing me as Registrar Representative on the GNSO Council as an observer. So I'll just run through a roll call of Council members for the record. Do we have Philip Shepherd?
Yes.
Mike Roddenbar. Alistair Dixon.
Yes.
Alistair. Chuck Gomes.
Yes.
Terry Carr.
Yes.
Okay. Edmund Chung.
Yep.
Thank you, Edmund. Tony Harris. Tony Holmes.
Yes, Bruce.
Tony. Greg Ruth?
Yes.
Robin Gross?
Yes, hi.
Hi, Robin. Norbert Klein? Milwaukee Chango?
Yes, of course.
Welcome, Milwaukee. Ross Rayner?
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening, Ross. Tom Keller?
I'm here.
Thank you, Tom. Bruce Tonkin is here. Arthur Decker? Kyoshi Zuru. Christina Rosette.
Yes.
Christina. John Bing.
John King, his apologies, Bruce. He has today.
Okay. Avery Doria.
Yes.
Avery. Sophia Beckerman. Okay.
And Suzanne Finn sends her apologies also, Bruce. She has back calls.
Okay, and do we have Alan Greenberg as the ABAC liaison?
Yes.
Thank you, Alan. Okay, so the agenda today consists of essentially ratifying the election result for the GNSO Council Chair and then reviewing the new GTLD recommendations. So first item on the agenda is if anyone wants to update any statements of interest, please say so now.
Hey Bruce, it's Rita Redfern. Excuse me, just wanted to mention that I'm on as well a little bit.
Good.
Right here.
Good, thank you, Rita. Okay, so approval of the GNSO Council minutes of the 24th of May. Glenn posted those I think just over a week ago, and there was one change made to replace the words, not what the original words were, but now that the word is roll call vote. So that's the only change I'm aware of. Would someone like to nominate those minutes be accepted?
I will, Bruce. It's Chuck.
Thank you, Chuck. And for Ken's benefit, Chuck has taken on the role that you used to perform on this valuable function, Ken, approving the minutes each meeting.
I hate to waste time.
It's passing the baton on.
That's right. Okay. All those in favour of accepting the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any against? And any abstentions?
Milwaukee.
Milwaukee, noted. Okay, the minutes of last meeting are passed. Item 3 on the agenda is ratifying the result of the election for the GNSO Council Chair. Glenn, would you like to report on the election result, please?
Yes, certainly, Bruce. There were 9 members who voted out of the 21, which accounted for 24 votes out of the 27. 2 council members did not return their ballots, accounting for 3 votes, 1 council member holding a single vote, and 1 council member holding a double vote. The votes added up to 15 votes for Avery Doria and 9 votes for Philip Shepherd. There were no abstentions. And according to the regulations, the winner must have a super, must have a majority of 14 or more votes. And if everybody has checked their confidential code, then it should be in order.
Okay, thank you, Glenn. Okay, I'd like to call then for vote to ratify that result. All those in favour, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Any against? Any abstentions? Okay, I'll now declare Avridoria as the next GNSO Council Chair, and I will cease that function at the end of this meeting, so I'll be handing the baton across to Avery.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank Philip Shepherd for standing in the election, and thank both Avery and Philip for willing to take on this role. Okay, item four is the interesting topic of reviewing the new GTLD recommendations. There has been quite a bit of discussion on the list, and I've just been sort of going through the recommendations myself again. I think perhaps what might be useful is to just run through the recommendations as they were posted by Liz Williams as the policy officer on the 10th of May, and just identify where the changes were from the previous draft of the recommendations that was published on the, I think it was March of this year. So those were the recommendations that were discussed during the Lisbon meeting, and the latest sort of additional changes has happened since then. So if I take the first recommendation, which is recommendation number one, the draft of March said that ICANN must implement a process that allows the introduction of new top-level names. There's been a second paragraph added to that recommendation, and that states that the evaluation and selection procedure for new GTLD registry should respect the principles of fairness, transparency and non-discrimination. All applicants for a new registry should therefore be evaluated against transparent and predictable criteria, fully available to the applicants prior to the initiation of the process, and normally, therefore, no subsequent additional selection criteria should be used in the selection process. So that basically was based on 2.5 of the GAP principles, and I haven't seen any dissent from that. I think it's a useful additional paragraph to that recommendation one. Does anyone have any comments on that first change, recommendation one? Okay. Recommendation two, the previous wording was a one-line sentence that basically said that the strings must not be confusingly similar to an existing top-level name. An additional paragraph has been added to that, which says, in the interest of consumer confidence and security, new GTLD should not be confusingly similar to existing TLDs. And then the second sentence is, to avoid confusion with country code top-level names, no two-letter GTLD should be introduced. I'm wondering that the first sentence of that second paragraph seems to more or less repeat the first sentence, so I suggest that I don't think that adds any value. We can add the bit about consumer confidence and security in our explanation for recommendation two. And then the second sentence, I think, is really referring to reserved words. It's saying to avoid confusion with country code names, no two-letter GTLD should be introduced. That seems to be essentially a reserved names criteria.
Bruce, this is Chuck. I'd like to just point out that in the Reserve Names Working Group report, that's exactly what we ended up recommending after quite a lot of discussion and debate.
Okay, so I suggest then that that second sentence, Chuck, get moved to the section on reserved words then. Would you agree?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Bruce, it's Liz here, and just to double check everyone. Hello, everyone, first of all. I am working on a version of the document in front of me, which is a recommendation overview, and I'm taking notes as we go, which says move here, move here, move here. I may need to just get you to go a little bit slowly because I'm going to put on the fly so I capture everything as they're going along.
Okay, so this is recommendation two.
Yep, got it. I'm just saying that I'm up with you, but in future I might just need to stop for a second?
Yeah, please slow. If anything you don't understand, please ask.
Malaki here.
Yeah, go ahead, Malaki.
So the procedure is that you are asking people about the ads on the previous version of the recommendation, or we are discussing the recommendation item by item?
What I'm pretty much doing, Malaki, is I'm going through, from a process point of view, I'm going through the recommendations item by item. Some of the recommendations I haven't seen any discussion on, for example, recommendation 1 and 2 on the list. So when we come to the recommendation 3, for example, where there has been a lot of discussion, we can talk about that whole recommendation, but I'm just sort of going through and identifying where I think there's issues.
Okay. Well, about this recommendation 2,
yes.
I have always expressed the concern about confusingly similar, preferring visually confusing or topographically confusing. But I remember in Marina del Rey, I think you discussed this while I was not yet in the meeting, and you said that it is because these expressions are based on legal practices that already existed. That's the case?
Yes, yeah, so that was the discussion as I understood it in Marina del Rey, yes.
Malaki, it's Liz here. Just to confirm that, Malaki, I did a lot of work in the background with the WIPO advisors and Jumin and her colleagues on this particular one, and frankly took her advice on the necessity to not have a qualifier, which was the visually confusingly similar, based on their vast experience in managing UDRP disputes about domain names. So that's why it remains there.
Okay, and this is documented in the full version of the report?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, remember, we're just looking at it at a you know, very high level table-like summary here, so it's all in the report.
Okay. Recommendation. So I'll just restate kind of what I see the change in recommendation 2, so we're clear. So the first sentence, strings must not be confusingly similar to an existing top-level name, stays. The first sentence of the second paragraph, delete. That doesn't need to be in the summary recommendation. And then the second sentence becomes part of the reserved word section, essentially.
Thanks, Bruce. Got it.
Okay. Recommendation 3. The original wording there was that was the first sentence, which strings must not infringe the existing legal rights of others that are recognised or enforceable under generally accepted and internationally recognised principles of law. A second paragraph has been added to that, and that states that the process of introducing new GTLDs must make proper allowance for prior third-party rights, in particular trademark rights, as well as rights in the names and acronyms of intergovernmental organisations. Now, that paragraph has been taken from the GAC principles, and I noticed there's been quite a bit of discussion on essentially that second paragraph. My suggestion, and I'll open this up for Robin and others to speak to this, because I know there's been a lot of discussion, but maybe we should stick with the first sentence, which is referring to existing legal rights of others that are enforceable under generally accepted and internationally recognisable principles of law. And then in the second paragraph, we could say something to the effect of examples include, but not limited to, rights protected under the Paris Convention for Protection of Industrial Property and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Because I think both of those are two examples of generally accepted international principles of law, and each of those are obviously very detailed. So both the Paris Convention and the Universal Declaration are extensive documents that cover, I think, a number of the points that people have made on the mailing list. But I'm interested in views, and perhaps hand it to Robin to comment on this first, and then others to comment.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I think that sounds like sort of a reasonable approach to go on this recommendation. I wonder, though, if we would want to, when we mentioned the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, specifically mention the freedom of expression guarantees, because that's really the part that we were concerned about being left out of the equation.
Yeah, I think if you can do that, and that if you did that, you'd then be balancing it by saying the Paris Convention, including the section on trademarks. I mean, I don't have an issue with adding it. I just wonder whether you need to be as specific as that. Other comments on that?
Bruce Phillips here. I'm happy also with that suggested change either way. Just want to know what reference you're going to make of what we currently see in parentheses in this table, which is the link to the pro-working group principle, which is clearly relevant.
Not sure. You tell me a bit more about what's coming from the pro-group there.
Well, maybe Christina can do that better than I.
Christine?
Yeah, thanks. Well, there are a number of basic level recommendations coming forth. I'm not entirely clear. Are you referring to some of the definitions that we came up with? I'm just really not quite clear as to what you want to link in there.
I'm merely referencing what I currently see in parentheses in this table that Liz has provided, which is a linkage and recognition that existing legal rights of others was the topic.
Okay. Perhaps I can help you out, both of you out here, because I don't know whether you've got the pro-working group proposed recommendations in front of you, which are buried deep in the report, and I'll just perhaps I can help you out here. I think that what we're actually talking about, Philip and Christina, is a way in which that particular recommendation could be implemented. So, for example, we've got the recommendation as it stands, and principle one in the pro-group stuff is that there is no universal rights protection mechanism. Yeah, these are really implementation. The pro-group came up with second-level implementation-related issues.
Okay, if that's the linkage, then that's all we need to do.
Yeah,
to
and
yeah.
Is that all right? And then I can just include that in the discussion if you wish.
Okay.
Yeah, so what, I'm not trying to wordsmith some of the linkages here. I'm just trying to get the words themselves right, and then it's kind of a second pass to sort of make sure the report's consistent with...
Okay, and again, perhaps just a question of language. At the moment it says principles. Maybe that's confusing if we've got our own A to F principles and we're now on recommendations. If that's implementation, then...
I'll put proposed recommendations, because the council, the committee haven't considered that report yet.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, fine.
Mawaki here. I'm not sure if I fully understand. Normally, the portion of text in brackets is not really part of the recommendation text, is it?
That's correct.
That's right.
I'll be clear on what I'm looking at.
Johnny Harris.
I'm reading off the document of the 10th of May, which was basically just the recommendations as they're listed. So I'm not going into all the references and things. And yes, more likely the references are more for reference as opposed to the recommendation themselves. So I agree with you.
Okay.
So let me just restate that as I understand it. So recommendation three, the first paragraph or first sentence stays the same, which is strings must not infringe the existing legal rights of others that are recognised or enforceable under generally accepted and internationally recognised principles of law. And then examples of these principles include, but are not limited to, the rights protected under the Paris Convention for Protection of Industrial Property, and we can just put brackets, trademarks after that, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and we can put in brackets freedom of speech after that.
Thanks, Bruce. Got it.
Bruce, this is Chuck. Could I make a suggestion just for logistic purposes? It would be really helpful if Liz could prepare a redline version of the recommendations that we can distribute to our constituencies. I know in our case, at least, we have vetted all of this with the constituency. It'd be really, real helpful if they could see the changes that are made in a redline form.
Sure, Chuck, but would you mind orange? Because that's the font that I've chosen to indicate the changes.
You can pick whatever color you want.
There we go. It's pretty orange today.
Okay. Recommendation four is unchanged, which is strings must not cause any technical instability. Recommendation five, the previous recommendation just had one sentence. It said strings must not be a reserved word. Since that previous recommendation, an additional paragraph has been added, which is ICANN should avoid country, territory or place names and country, territory or regional language or people description unless in agreement with the relevant governments or public authorities. Now, that's a paragraph that's come from the GATT principles, but I notice that that's kind of contrary to at least what the reserve word working group came up with. If I understood correctly, Chuck, you're saying that that there doesn't seem to be any, I guess, international law that covered all those
right, and I think that the reserve names working group recommendation tried to handle this in a way that is not exactly what some of the GAC members wanted, at the same time to respect the concern that they have. But yeah, this wording here would be different, and also I think this is a reserve name issue that probably doesn't need to be in the recommendations itself.
Yeah, I agree. My suggestion is to remove that second paragraph from the actual recommendations themselves. I mean, we can note in the discussion that that's what the GAC had recommended, but I think we also need to take in the reserve names working group recommendations as a whole and ask the staff to sort of put forward what the like the reserved words policy is, if you like, or reserved words list is for public comment. So sort of deal with that process separately. Any other comments on that?
This is Norbert speaking. I mean, I also think what Chuck suggested and just what you just said makes it much clearer to have the general statement and not go again into all the details. Thank you.
Thank you, Norbert. Ross, was it right
here? Yeah, as it relates to that specific set of reservations or the specific request coming from the GAC, I'd also, if you're going to take that approach, I think that's the wise way to do it. I'd want to understand how the intersection of place names and trademarks, in other words, if there is a place name and a trademark that are being that are in conflict, which is actually quite common, I'd be interested in understanding how the policy is going to work with that. In other words,
I don't think I've got an answer for that, but that can be something that we need to get some advice on. Yeah.
Right.
Ross, it's Liz here. I'm just picking up that text, which doesn't actually relate to the actual recommendation. Would you mind, it's an important question I need to capture, would you just mind flicking me one line that says, don't forget place names and trademarks?
Certainly.
And I'll get some specific advice.
Okay, so the change in recommendation 5, Liz, is removing that second paragraph?
Yep, got it.
The recommendation remains, strings must not be a reserved word, full stop.
Yep, got it.
Recommendation 6. Strings must not be. Recommendation 6 again had a single sentence originally, which is strings must not be contrary to generally accepted legal norms relating to morality and public order. The additional text that's been added to that, again, I think is picking up some of the words from the GAC principles, and that is that new GDLD should respect A, the provisions of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which seek to affirm, quoted, fundamental human rights in the dignity and worth of the human person and in the equal rights of men and women, close quote. And B, the sensitivities regarding terms with national, cultural, geographic and religious significance. I've sort of had another look at this one as well, and I noticed the actual terminology of our original recommendation, which is strings must not be generally... It must not be contrary to generally accepted legal norms related to morality and public order. That text comes in two places. It's fairly similar to text in the Paris Convention, but with some additional words. So in the Paris Convention it says, contrary to morality or public order, and in particular of such a nature as to deceive the public, and in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, there's also some similar words. But what again I'd suggest is we perhaps treat this similar to the way I've suggested treating recommendation 3. We should adjust 6 to be to pick up the words accepted, generally accepted and internationally recognised under principles of perhaps under generally accepted internationally recognised principles of law, so we add that phrase that we have for recommendation 3. And again, we just say examples for the purpose of interpretation, well, examples, I guess, of these international principles of law include those under the Paris Convention, and we can reference the section and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's a fairly similar issue, I think, to Recommendation 3, and I think we should use consistent wording.
Bruce, Mawaki here.
Yeah, go ahead, Mawaki.
Just a general note to warn a little bit against the systematic parallel you tend to draw between our recommendation and international conventions. Paris Convention is an international agreement, and it has been ratified by governments. I mean, it has been signed by governments, not all of them, and all of those who signed may have not ratified it. So those, it applies to those who signed and ratified the convention. And we are setting recommendation for the internet community, which is pervasive and global and concern individual users, companies and all sort of entities. So we don't necessarily have to keep the same wordings like the same wording like in convention we may want to specify, like I think that's the case with the amendment we are proposing, that I don't know if our recommendation can speak to the applicants. We can just try to let them know that it's up to them to make sure to apply for strings that are sustainable in their jurisdiction. That's all my comments. Thanks.
Okay. So Mikey, if I'm understanding your, I think the comments are fair. I think there's two things. One is what this recommendation is, whether we have it there or not. And the second is your advice to applicants, which is a slightly separate thing. So certainly the advice to applicants can draw applicants to their attention, you know, things to look out for in their application, if you like. I think that's certainly consistent that there would be some kind of document or paper that's advice to applicants. But this, what we're concerned with right now is what our actual policy recommendation is. So the policy recommendation currently says strings must not be contrary to, and the words are generally accepted legal norms relating to morality and public order. What I've suggested is that's augmented with the same sort of wording we have in Recommendation 3, that it's recognised or enforceable under generally accepted and internationally recognised principles of law. And by internationally recognised, that doesn't mean every country in the world recognises it, but that a fair cross-section of countries do. And I think both the Paris Convention and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I would assume that both of those have perhaps at least a majority of countries in the world that have signed those.
Bruce, just to be informative, it's 171 states for the Paris Convention.
And what about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
Don't have that one in front of me, sorry.
Well, I think all the UN member states have ratified the Universal Declaration.
Okay, so let me ask that because I'm not into international politics. So how many countries are a member of the UN?
Something around 200, but I don't have the specific figure.
Right, yeah, the orders of magnitude, yeah.
Bruce is Mary.
That's the most universal that you can get.
I'll get the exact numbers and put it in the text.
Miriam, go ahead.
Yeah. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted by the General Assembly when the United Nations was founded in 1948. At that time, there were maybe 50 countries, but being a General Assembly resolution, it's obviously taken on a much larger force of its own. I will say, though, people should understand, it's not itself a treaty. It has become what we call customary international law because there have subsequently been treaties adopted, like the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, that reflect provisions of the Universal Declaration. So it has become customary international law, but itself is not a treaty. But I think it's fair to say that most of the world does regard the provisions in the Declaration as legally binding, not because of the Declaration per se, but because of the force that it's taken on over the years and because of the treaty commitments that they have made in other UN contexts and also in regional conventions like the Latin American Convention on Human Rights, the European Convention on Human Rights, etc.
Hey, Bruce, it's John Nevin. I think the UN has 192 members.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you, John.
Bruce, can I just ask a question about this? I just want to make sure I understand. So we're talking about, this is Robin. We're talking about altering 6. So are we talking about basically just altering A and B of 6, or are we talking about altering the language of 6 before we get to the 6A and 6B?
That's correct. Yeah, I'm talking about the first sentence.
Okay, so then it would be that it would say strings must not be contrary to generally accepted legal norms relating to morality and public order. What would we change that to?
It would be strings must not be contrary to legal norms relating to morality and public order as generally accepted under internationally recognized principles of law.
Okay, and then would we not have A or B at all?
What I was suggesting is the same approach we did for 3, that we would then say examples of those, examples but not limited to of those international recognized principles of law would include from the Paris Convention and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, because that the sort of wording about morality and public orders in both of those.
Yeah, I think I would generally be okay with that as long as we specifically point to the freedom of expression guarantees in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Okay, so we can do that similar to the way we did with 3, then we just put that in brackets.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Robin, I'll also do that in the text.
Now, just a clarification, Bruce, this is Chuck. So you had mentioned when we were talking about 3 that if you refer to freedom of expression as an example, then you would probably also need to refer to trademark rights in the Paris Convention as an example. Is that?
Yeah, so it's actually in Article 6 of the Paris Convention, referring to the topic of marks, protection of marks. It then has a section there about that those marks should not be contrary to morality and public order. So I guess what we're trying to do is sort of the way you interpret the first sentence, I think, should be pretty general, that must be related to international law, norms, etc. And then the second paragraph, if you like, because if you're building a dispute process, you'd be basically saying that these are the international laws or examples of international laws you should be using.
Yeah, and I'm fine with your approach. I'm just trying to clarify. So if we refer to freedom of expression, you suggested that we would also refer to mark rights. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think the key that I was suggesting, Chuck, that basically we are referring to the entirety of both of those, but we are drawing to attention that the freedom of expression and is in the Universal Declaration is one of the many things, and trademarks is in the Paris Convention as one of many things.
Yeah, and Robin, you're okay with that approach.
That's right. I am okay with that approach.
Thanks.
Let me just make sure I understand, though. So then we would be the B that we currently have, that's the sensitivities regarding terms with national, cultural, geographic, and religious significance, the GAC 2-1 principle. So then we would be taking that off of our recommendation.
That's correct, yeah, unless you can find the equivalent national, international law that has
that would words. That would really do a lot to to make NCUC much happier with our recommendations, because that's the one that's really...
Yeah, the principle I'm taking is that we're referring to actual existing documents. These are actual treaties that have been signed by lots of people. If we add something else in, by all means, but then you need to be able to reference it back to whatever that international treaty is.
Fair enough.
So, Bruce Malaki, I'm okay with that too, but I was just wondering about the word, the wording. I understand strings must not be contrary to legal norm and trademark, etc. But I'm not sure if it's okay to keep it that way, in the sense that, can we, is it possible to say string must not be contrary to human declaration, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? Because the initial idea was not to infringe some existing rights.
Yeah, that's in Recommendation 3.
Yeah.
So we've covered that under Recommendation 3, which is the legal rights there.
No, I'm talking now of Recommendation 6, and I'm just pointing out the wording of the recommendation. We have string must not be contrary to, etc. And I don't understand how strings must not be contrary to Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
No, sorry. The wording states, so let me say that again. The first sentence is that, and I'm wordsmithing off the top of my head here, so I can probably get better than this, but strings must not be contrary to legal norms related to morality and public order as generally accepted under international recognised principles of law, full stop. And then examples of those international principles of law, but not limited to, is the Paris Convention and the Declaration of Human Rights.
And what I'm saying is it's okay for existing the convention, Paris Convention, for example, but I think the string, it's not up to the string not to be contrary to freedom of expression. It's, I think, those who allow the string or don't, who need to follow the Declaration of Human Rights or freedom of expression rights. You understand?
Right, okay, yeah, I understand.
Bruce, I can help out.
Yeah, go ahead, Philip.
I think Mark is onto I think a good point actually. What we'll need to do, and I don't suggest we work with it now because you need to look at the text. But what we need to do in relation to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is make reference to two separate sections, one of which is the part to do with freedom of expression, and the second is to do with the part which is actually to do with limitations on freedom of expression, which relates to morality and public order. And it's those two things you need together. That are the crucial components of that, of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Yeah, and I think what Mark is also saying, though, is that the I suppose the subject of the sentence saying strings, it's not quite the right wording. I know what you're getting at. I don't want to try and do it right now, but yeah. it's not the strings.
The strings are our starting point, of course. We've got to start the strings because that's what we're talking about.
We need the sentence to be semantically correct.
Yeah.
That's right, yes. Yep.
I just wanted to ask a question about that. So are we saying then that the restrictions that some countries would use, would have on free speech, can then be applied to the whole policy, or would they just be kept within those countries? That's the important part for us, is whether or not
the restrictions
are going to be expanded to include everyone.
Yeah, I think that is an interesting point. I think the approach is that we are using what's generally accepted under international principles of law under that category, Robin, but we're not saying that an individual country that says, you know, I don't like this particular word because it's, you know, it's against my religion or something, just that country isn't enough. You understand the separation now? I'm saying this is under internationally recognised principles of law on morality and public order. It's not the same as saying if I have a law in one country that is specific about a particular word that's against morality, that on its own doesn't mean it applies to the whole world. Not specifically.
Okay, but if there was a couple of countries maybe that agreed on a particular word, but the rest of the world's okay with it, would applicants in the rest of the world be allowed to register that domain? That's what I'm concerned with. Is they're outside of the countries that don't allow that discussion, so they wouldn't be violating any laws that they live in, or any laws that they're obligated to live by. I just want, I'm concerned that we're going to, what we'll do is we'll take those restrictions in a few countries and sort of impose them on the whole world.
That's definitely not the intent. The intent of the wording of the first sentence is to actually avoid that.
Okay, so but that's just why I would be concerned with adding in language that limits the free expression principle, because that limitation could be meant then for the whole policy as opposed to just those parts of the world who have that limitation.
No, but Robin, the language I'm suggesting that you added in there is the language that it is in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Right, but what I'm saying is those countries...
You can't avoid that. It's part of the Universal Declaration.
Right.
If you want to go back and rewrite the Universal Declaration.
For those countries, not for the whole world, but for those countries.
Yeah, that's an implementation issue, which is in terms of a highly restrictive implementation or more liberal one. And I think that's beyond us in terms of how it's interpreted. All we can say is how we intend it.
Okay. And we would intend that it wouldn't apply outside of those jurisdictions.
Coming from our democratic background, I'm sure you and I would.
Yeah, so what we're trying to attempt to do here is to say that we're saying that it's consistent with those international principles of law, but it has to be generally accepted internationally, I think is the words there. So if I have a word in the Australian context would be something like ANZAC, which happens to refer to returned soldiers from a war some time ago. That word means something in Australia, but it can't be just applied to the whole world.
Okay.
Because it's not a generally accepted issue of public order, if you like.
I see. Okay. Okay, then this is definitely a big improvement.
Okay. Seven, then, is recommendation seven, is applicants must be able to demonstrate their technical capability to run a registry operation. The additional phrase was added for the purpose that the applicant sets out. I think that's a constructive additional phrase. Does anyone have any comments on that, recommendation seven?
And Bruce, this is Chuck. I think that addition is consistent with the discussion that we actually had and what we agreed to.
Okay. Recommendation eight originally just said applicants must be able to demonstrate their financial and organisational operational capability. Then a second paragraph has been added to that, which is an application will be rejected or otherwise deferred if it is determined based on public comments or otherwise that there is substantial opposition to it from among significant established institutions of the economic sector or cultural language community to which it is targeted or which it is intended to support. Now, Robin's comment on this was that the second paragraph doesn't directly relate to the first sentence, and I tend to agree with that. What I suggest for the moment is let's label that second paragraph recommendation 20 for a second, because I think we just want to keep those two concepts separated. But that paragraph was previously in the recommendations under 14B, I think it was. And 14B, I suggest it didn't really relate to string contention either, so I did suggest to Liz that we move it up. But I don't think it is part of Recommendation 8. It's a new recommendation, essentially, that fits in that area, if that makes sense. But I gather you also have concern about the wording itself. Is that right, Robin?
I'm concerned about the idea of a public opposition process, in particular what that's going to mean for objective and measurable and pre-published criteria for being able to apply. I'm concerned that if we open it up for a public objection process, that it would be very difficult to get applicants through because there are no limitations, as far as I know, of what could be a legitimate opposition, and oppositions from one part of the world, I don't think should necessarily stop a string. I mean, not everyone is always going to be happy about everything that we do, and that's okay. I mean, if you know, if something is offensive to someone or controversial to someone, as long as it's lawful, I think we should let it go forward. So I'm concerned that we're opening up a big can of worms with this public opposition process.
Bruce, could I comment on that, Chuck?
Go ahead, Chuck.
Robin, I think you're looking at this in a much broader sense than the way it's worded. Notice that it says substantial opposition. I think substantial is the key word. And that opposition is from significant established institutions of the economic sector or culture or language community to which it is targeted. So if there's a TLD, and the first example I think that we talked about with this idea was the idea of a dot bank, okay? If there was substantial opposition from the banking industry globally, then I think this recommendation would apply, because a dot bank presumably would be targeted to the banking industry. And I believe that was the intent of this. And when you looked at it, there's two key things. First of all, substantial opposition. The intent was not that a few people could just oppose something. It really needs to be significant opposition from a targeted a stakeholder group for the TLD. That's very different than just having a complaint process where somebody can say, this offends me, and therefore it wouldn't be allowed.
I see the point you're making, but I still think that it is too broad of a process, even, you know, just saying a significant opposition. I mean, because this is another situation where it strikes me that opposition from the Catholic Church would be sufficient to...
But for dot Catholic, right? So I think that's what we're saying. It's not you couldn't have the Catholic Church opposing something because the particular topic was against their religion, but the Catholic Church could complain about someone asking for dot Catholic,
or they could also complain about someone asking for dot religion.
And what is
the Catholic Church? I don't think they could, actually.
Well, under this definition, they would be a significant institution, and they could certainly launch a significant opposition. So I think it is broad enough to include that.
And Bruce,
if it was dot religion.
Bruce, it's Marilyn. I apologize about speaking, but may I just offer an example? Because I think it might help.
Yep, go ahead.
If the Catholic Church objected, but the majority of other religions supported a dot religion, there would be significant opposition from one party, from one religious group, but significant support from others. And I thought we tried very hard to make sure that that would then allow such a name to go forward. And I apologize about intervening, because I'm just an observer.
Bruce, this is Denise. Can I get in the queue?
Can I get the queue too, please?
Yeah, I'll take a queue, I think, because there's a few people that want to talk to this.
Put up at the end of the queue, and that's the job's done for me. Then.
I might just slow down, because I can't capture that quite as fast as all that. So I had Denise. I had, was it Ross Rader?
It was Alistair.
Alistair, sorry.
Milwaukee.
Milwaukee.
I'm Philip.
I've got Denise, Alistair, Milwaukee. Anyone else?
Alan Gilbert.
Alan, anyone else?
Tony Harris at the end.
Tony Harris, anyone else?
I heard Philip asking too, Bruce.
Okay, Philip.
He was ahead of me.
Okay. I'm not going to worry about order. I just want to make sure I've got everyone's name. Go ahead, Denise.
Thanks. Robin, I understand your concern, and we got the policy services and legal ICANN staff together on Monday and Tuesday, and spent a significant amount of time going through this and discussing this particular issue. What we'll be doing is providing the council with another draft that details the proposed implementation guidelines based on the guidance and the policy recommendations that we're getting from the council. And so
we'll have an opportunity to have a detailed discussion with the council on this and similar issues that the staff have to take from the policy recommendations and provide detailed guidelines on how the objections and disputes might be handled. And so, you know, we're moving through a process that allows for a lot of feedback and guidance from the council to ensure that these types of concerns and nuances are captured in the implementation guidelines.
Okay. Alistair Dixon?
Thanks, Bruce. I have a couple of comments. Firstly, I just on the point around the Catholic Church opposition to say dot religion. I mean, they may be a significant established institution, but they by themselves don't constitute substantial opposition. It's actually would require multiple such significant institutions to constitute substantial opposition. So I can't see why a single significant institution would indeed be a problem. But it seems, secondly, it seems to me, and I think certainly in the IDN context, but I think in other contexts as well, that this is actually, I think, quite an important requirement. Certainly, speaking from a New Zealand context, I can think of communities here that where a domain name may be targeted at a community, and that community may wish to have a say as to whether, you know, they support having that particular domain going forward, and actually representing that community. So it seems to me that it's important that communities have the ability to say whether they support it or not, and provided there isn't substantial opposition, and I mean, to me, substantial is not just a majority, but a significant majority, then the domain should go ahead. I think there is, in the wording there, a presumption for the application to go ahead, unless there is actually an overwhelming majority of opposition against it going ahead.
Okay. Milwaukee?
Okay, yeah. I'm not trying to be polemic here, but I just wanted to understand, if we had this recommendation in place before the application for XXX, for example, and the Catholic Church opposed that, would it be substantial enough to withdraw the application?
I don't believe so, because I don't think the Catholic Church is the established institution of the pornography industry.
Okay. Second part.
Because I think that this particular recommendation is referring to that the string is related to that institutional cultural sector.
Okay, I wanted to get that clear. The second thing is, and the last one, I would like to understand what exactly would be the problem if a string like that bank, they apply for the bank and they say their activities will be, their purpose will be to target the bank industry. And there is opposition from the bank industry, but the applicant persists. And if I can allow this GTLD, is it that a big deal to let the GTLD operate and see whether they succeed or not? And if the business is not sustainable, that would be the problem of the, you know, the registry. Do you think that there's other issues?
So just state that one again for me. I'm not sure I understood. So, yeah. So it's dot bank, and what's the nature of the opposition?
Yeah, the opposition. There is opposition from the bank industry, but the applicant persists and say, "I have. I'm sure I'll succeed in this business. I have a business model that seems to me, on the long run, it will work."
Okay, so I don't think the opposition is based on opposing the business model. I think the intent here of the opposition is that that particular industry does not want that applicant to represent it, or that TLD to represent it.
And we wouldn't
allow so it's not an opposition of business model. It's an opposition of, let's say I, Bruce Tonkin, applied for .bank. I have absolutely nothing to do with banking. I'm not qualified in that area or anything else. And so it would be, I would not be able to open a bank in Australia, for example, under Australian law. You know, I'd have to pass a whole lot of criteria. It's a regulated industry. I think that's kind of where some of the discussion was.
So we are saying that, we are implying that a registry should be, or a string, a TLD string should be run by or operated by an entity that that represents the industry or the sector.
And that's the other way around. It's that you can, if there's no objection, if you apply for .bank and there is no substantial opposition from the banking industry, you can run .bank. So there's no prohibition on running .bank, but the issue is that the banking industry can object, and if it's a substantial objection, then you know that they have standing to do so.
This is Robin. Can I get in the queue?
Yeah, I'll add you after Philip, Robin.
If Ken stops up, I could ask a question at the end. I'd appreciate it.
And I'd add you as well. Thanks, Ken.
Just a last remark. Is this not... are we not getting, with this, are we not getting closer to the sponsor of GTLD as opposed to just GTLD?
No, because again, this is just an opposition method. It's not a criteria for whether you're allowed to have a TLD or not. So it's purely opposition. Whereas the sponsored TLD was, it's a requirement. You have to have the support of the sponsored community to have the TLD. This is actually the complete reverse of a sponsored TLD. It's saying anyone can have it unless there is substantial opposition from an institution. So the onus goes on the objective of the onus in the sponsored TLD, the onus is on the person that's putting the application forward to prove that they represented the community. This one, the onus is on the party objecting to prove that they represent that community. So to give a specific example of .travel, there was one individual that complained about .travel. Under this recommendation, he would not have standing because he's just one individual. He's not representing the whole travel industry when he is objecting to .travel.
Thank you.
Alan?
I think the first part is partially addressed by what Denise said, that I think the actual words as here are not sufficient, and they're going to have to be backed up with process. Just saying something is can be deferred, we need to understand what the process is on how it gets undeferred, how it goes back on the table. The whole thing, on the other hand, is out of line with the intention that this be a predictable and understandable process and the timelines be understandable, because this could go on forever. As it's worded. My other comment is purely...
So just so let's be clear on that, Alan, this is actually part of a process where that would be, you know, that they have whatever the time is, 30 days to lodge that objection.
No, I understand that, but if we then think it is deferred pending something...
But sorry, what,
you know, again,
what's deferred, sorry?
Pardon me?
What is deferred?
There's wording in this recommendation on this, saying it could be deferred.
Oh, I sorry, I agree. Yeah, I think that's...
That could be the start of a long process.
Yeah,
perhaps
exactly. No, I think the or otherwise deferred causes an issue in their wording, because this is a process where it's a yes or no, and then you can go into the next round as if it's no is the intent.
Oh, okay.
So it should be an application will be rejected if it is determined that there is substantial opposition, should be the wording.
Okay. My other comment is purely cosmetic. This is the only recommendation that really is stated as a negative instead of as a positive. And maybe that's unavoidable.
Okay. Tony Harris?
Yes, I just wanted to say I share Robin's concerns as she voiced them actually. The discussion actually went past my comments, so I'll defer right now.
Okay, Philip Shepherd.
Just to say, I think we have more or less. I think the spirit of what we want to achieve is clear. I'm happy to hear from Denise that there'll be clarification in terms of what that would look like as implementation. I think that's quite useful. And would like to reiterate also what Chuck and others have said. But I think we've got the language here mostly right in talking about substantial opposition, significant institutions, and linking it into names that are targeted towards representatives of those institutions. So there's a tree of limitation in terms of the nature of the objection there. And go back to the example we're talking about in terms of dot bank. Of course, what we're trying to avoid is harm and an illegal activity. An example of dot bank, we're trying to prevent somebody setting up dot bank, taking registrations for Citibank dot bank, taking money where these people have no representation to those institutions, and it's just a means of fraud. So we're looking at means of avoiding harm mostly by. To my mind, by this new recommendation 20.
I think it's also just that we are giving the example of dot bank, but I think the other example that's been talked about in the context of this, and I think it's worth just stating it, is if it was a city name. So if it was dot Sydney, for example, and the citizens of Sydney, Australia, Sydney, Nova Scotia, and wherever else Sydney is in the world were all complaining about it, then that would be another example. So it's not just necessarily something like bank, but it could also be a geographic identifier, or dot Maori would be another example. So I just wanted to give some other examples. Robin Gross?
Yeah, I still think that this is too sort of open-ended and ambiguous, because it strikes me that this could just be set up to try to prevent a competitor from getting a competitive advantage. If one banking company is the first to get their application in, I think this public opposition process could then open up an opportunity for all their competitors to get together and say, no, we don't want him to be the dot bank. He's not the official spokesman of the banking industry. We really are. And whether it's about banking or cultural terms or geographic terms, I feel like we're just kind of opening up a can of worms for sort of anyone to have any grievance for any purpose that could then slow or prevent a domain from being issued. So I'm just not at all comfortable with this. With this public opposition process that could allow for oppositions that aren't based on law, basically, that are just based on, it offends me, or I feel like I'm the real spokesman for this idea, for this issue. I think we should avoid all of those kinds of conflicts, and just if it's a lawful string, and if they meet technical criteria, those are the issues that should be taken into consideration in evaluating the string.
Bruce, just Chuck, please add me to the queue.
And Alan Greenberg.
And Liz, please, Bruce.
Chuck, Alan, and Liz. Anyone else want to be added to the queue? Okay.
Norbert, can you also please add me?
Norbert, yes.
Yes.
Ken, you were next?
Yeah, it's commonly a question and comment. Discussion today makes it perfectly clear to me that we need, in order to be fair and open in terms of disclosure, when we finally issue the RFP, I'm going to strongly recommend that ICANN publish a set of guidelines that could be a compendium and actually go on into the future for future RFPs that covers exactly how these processes will work. And the logic behind the process is as important as well. And the reason is applicants need to have some sense of predictability. Having been an applicant before in prior years and seeing the process change totally in midstream, it's very, very frustrating. So I think you need to make absolutely certain that somewhere there's a clear set of guidelines on how these processes will work, and as important, behind it. I hope people understand what I'm talking about there.
I understand and I agree, Malati.
Yeah, so that's certainly consistent with the first recommendation that basically said that all applicants for a registry should be evaluated against transparent and predictable criteria, fully available to the applicants prior to the initiation of the process, and therefore no subsequent additional selection criteria should be used in that selection process. So that's basically recommendation one that's consistent with that. I think what you're saying though, Ken, if I understand correctly, is that before you issued an RFP, this particular area, we would need to be very clear on defining what substantial was in respect to the word substantial opposition, and also define what's meant by significant established institution somehow. So certainly this would need work before it could be used as part of the RFP. Chuck.
Yes, thanks, Bruce. Three points. Number one, there are a few of the recommendations, and the ones we're really, and they're really, I think, the ones that we're spending a lot of time on today, that I think it's going to be difficult to totally finalize until we really focus on the implementation guidelines. And Philip hinted at that, and I think someone else did too. So I think it's important that we don't, in the few number of recommendations where this is the case, that we're going to need to look at the implementation process, at least at a high level, before we totally are comfortable with everything. And so I don't think we need to totally resolve it until we can get to that point on these few recommendations. Number two, if I'm targeting a particular community and I want to apply for a string, it seems to me that it's if I'm going to be smart, I'm going to make sure I have support from the people that will be impacted by that or that are targeted. And if I don't do that, I'm sorry. And like Ken said, you know, we the criteria will be out front. It'll be open. It'll be transparent. And hopefully we can develop objective ways of measuring the significance and the targeted community, et cetera. But as long as we're up front about that, then it's the responsibility of the applicant to make sure that they have the support of a community that they're targeting. And again, we're talking about a targeted community in this particular case, not that every TLD is going to be targeted towards the community. And then last of all, I'm sure we'll have some cases where every constituency doesn't totally support a recommendation. And there's going to be opportunity for minority statements in those cases. And so we need to, I don't think we need to keep reiterating our opposition to things. When it comes down and the council actually has to decide on these recommendations, there will be opportunity for minority statements if people do continue to disagree.
Yeah, I think the other issue on this, if I comment too, is that something like this is complicated, and you know there will be an implementation for it, and it may not be perfectly right, but there is an opportunity to fix it in the following round. So I don't think we're creating something that blocks a particular TLD for all time. If somehow the process gives outcomes we weren't expecting, the rules can always be changed before the next round, for example. So I think that's worth bearing in mind as well.
Right.
So I don't think we'll get it right the first time around. Alan.
Yeah, I guess I'm speaking in objection to what Robin said of, do we want to be able to refuse a TLD because people object? And I think the answer is yes. I think we perhaps need to come up with a good example to use as a test case to understand what happens. The Dot Music, I think, is the one that I like, because if Dot Music comes in and says, we are supported by ASCAP, you know, a large organization, a large well-known organization that looks at music issues, is that going to be sufficient? Or does RAA or BMI have the right to object, saying, no, we're the large organization? You know, it's an area where there are several competing organizations. And we need to understand how ICANN will respond to this kind of case, where there are several competing organizations within the U.S., there are probably similar ones within Europe and other parts of the world. How will we respond? And I think we need to work through
not in this document, but the procedures need to be worked through to understand how we will respond and make it clear in the procedures. There are going to be some really difficult cases where there are competing organizations representing industries, certainly even within the U.S. and probably more so within the world. That's my comment.
Well, this is Kurt. There's also a scenario where somebody applies for Dot Music and purports not to represent any organization, just to love music, and therefore, you know, should an application for a sort of generic word be rejected because it pledges not to represent a group?
You're giving yet another version of the same thing, yes.
Okay. Liz Williams.
Yeah, hi, Bruce. It's Liz here. Just what I wanted to let the group know is that we've done quite a lot of work on this over the last couple of days, and we had this chart in front of us, and we added additional columns to the right, and we said we looked at each and every recommendation, and we said, how would we measure this? What test would we use? How would we handle an objection? And then we ran through a series of random potential strings, and we used that as a live test of how the system would work. That work is still under consideration, and how one measures substantial opposition, how one justifies it, how one tests it, especially in a, for example, in my case, in a language community that could be in Urdu or Tamil or whatever, is actually quite a difficult task. So we spent a lot of time doing that, and that we'll be coming back with more information with the implementation impacts document for the San Juan meeting.
Okay, and Norbert.
Yeah, what I wanted to say is very similar to what Liz said, or the question of predictability, which had been raised before. I have great difficulties to understand how significant or substantial really could be measured in a situation where different communities have their own different organizations, or like Tamil was mentioned, this is a language spoken in different countries. It is organized by different groups. How could we ever decide which is significant and substantial and the other not? The same is the banking industry. I mean, there is not one banking industry of the world. And therefore my question, as long as we go with significant and substantial and not with technical and formalistic criteria, I think we are going to have a very, very difficult procedure. Thanks.
Thank you, Norbert. Anyone else want to comment on this one?
Yeah, Malaki, short comment.
Go ahead, Malaki.
Yeah, thanks. So it looks like this recommendation is one of those we need to wait for further work on in order to decide on. So I just wanted to make sure that at the beginning you were saying that this certain paragraph needs to be moved somewhere.
Yeah, what I was suggesting was we'll just call it Recommendation 20 for the moment. I just don't want to confuse it with Recommendation 8, which is relatively straightforward. Recommendation 8 just says applicants must demonstrate their financial and organisational capability or operational capability, full stop. So I think we leave Recommendation 8 as is, but we take this second paragraph out and just call it Recommendation 20 for the purpose of discussion.
Okay. So, yes, I totally agree with what Ken Starr said and Alan Greenberg said. We need to work in a direction that, in a sense that when we publish the recommendation, when we release the report and the recommendation, we do have a clear outline or clear detail about the implementation guidelines and how these things will be handled, especially the most ambiguous recommendations. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments on this one?
Bruce, this is Miriam. Can I make a comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted, this is consistent with some of the comments that have been made, and I just wanted to remind counselors that during the evaluation of the STLDs, the evaluators had criteria, been given criteria that were considered to be subjective. And in that context, terms like determining substantial, determining what's established, what's significant and established, based on public comments, based on other factors, those kinds of terms seem somewhat similar to some of the subjective criteria that the evaluators were faced with in the last round.
Okay.
Hey, Bruce, this is Ray. Can I make one comment?
Yeah, go ahead, Ray.
Thank you. Just to offer a slightly different perspective, I think it's a reality that if an applicant is interested in a generic word of where a lot of parties might have interest in it, that it is going to be a more difficult process than a fanciful word or a made-up term. I don't think we can escape that reality, and we can't come up with an exact science formula when we don't know what the applications are going to be when we're trying to encourage parties to apply. But we should, in our recommendations, be clear to have your eyes open that if you're going after a particular strain that others might be interested in, it is going to be a more difficult process.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the comment I wanted to make.
Good comment.
Okay, thanks, Ray. All right, well, at this point, Liz, if you can just relabel this paragraph as Recommendation 20.
Yep, got it.
And I'm wondering, between now and San Juan, is there likelihood that the staff would able to, you know, I don't know, give us an implementation paper or you know, be able to talk to us about the implementation or should say potential implementation of
this? Yes, Bruce, that's under preparation. And I'll be preparing an updated version of the implementation guidelines, which will be the updated version of the November 2006 document that I prepared.
So we'll also have a research paper that gives you really detailed examples of a variety of different mediation, dispute resolution, and other existing processes that we'll be considering and factoring into our implementation guidelines.
Yeah, but I think this one particularly, Denise, we need to just have some thought
yeah.
because if it's a lot of people are kind of raising issues about whether it's implementable. And I think that's what concerns me. I think most of the others I can see how you could implement it, but this one I'm a bit unclear.
Yes. We'll definitely be addressing this area.
Okay. All right, so I'll move on to the next one, Recommendation 9, which is... let me just make sure it didn't change. Okay, that stayed the same. So that just says, Recommendation 9, there must be a clear and pre-published application process using objective and measurable criteria. So that's no change. Recommendation 10, there must be a base contract provided to applicants at the beginning of the application process. That hasn't changed either. Recommendation 11 hasn't changed, but I did note that Robin made some comments about that, but I think have some validity in that. The way it's worded at the moment, the staff evaluators will be used to make preliminary determinations about applications as part of the process, which includes the use of expert panels to make decisions. I don't know, is that a policy recommendation or is that more just sort of, you know, it's part of the process, isn't it? And the process is that at some point you produce a preliminary report and it goes to public comment, etc. Just trying to see whether that really is a standalone recommendation or not.
Bruce, it's Liz here. I would have thought that it fits better in the implementation guidelines part.
Yeah, I just tend to think, because that on its own, because really you're just talking about part of a process, because the staff evaluators would probably make comments about financial and operational criteria, which is, you know, very much part of the staff process, and then there's other things that are very much outside of the staff's expertise where you wouldn't expect much to be made other than drawing people's attention to it, but then it would go to some outside body of some form. I just think it's, you either make it a really big, you know, long description or probably remove it, I think.
Bruce, it's Alan. There is a statement in there which says clearly and definitively expert panels will make the decisions as opposed to staff making the decisions.
Yes.
That's a policy issue. Saying we are not, ICANN itself will not make the decision, we will always rely on expert panels. I'm not sure that was the intent, but I think that's the way it reads right now.
Malarkey.
That would be a policy
well,
issue. That's what
well, it says includes the use rather than requires the use. But my sort of recommendation would probably be that we remove that as a standalone recommendation and sort of incorporate that in sort of the implementation, which would be the way we've handled it in the committee is we have some charts sort of just showing how the workflow works, and there's documents produced as preliminary reports and final reports and so on.
That works for me.
Yeah, Bruce, but if I agree. I think that was our intent when we wordsmithed that. It's an implementation of some of the other things we've already discussed.
Okay. So, Liz, if we
can...
I'm sorry, who's that?
This is Robin. Can I get in the queue?
Yeah, go ahead, Robin, yes.
Yeah, I agree with moving this concept to the implementation field. The only thing that I would change is I think we need to add the words objective, operational, technical, and financial criteria to what the staff is going to be evaluating so that it remains purely operational, technical, and financial, and that there isn't an opportunity for policy decisions, I guess, to be made as to what words are too controversial or who the appropriate party would be to represent a certain idea. So we wanted some kind of direction given to the evaluation that would be going on by the staff. And I actually moved for expert panels since we are only talking about, or since in our proposal we would only be talking about operational, technical, and financial criteria. So there wouldn't be a need for expert panels to determine these preliminary issues.
Bruce, can I get in the queue? Chuck?
Yeah, anyone else want to be in the queue?
Philip?
Anyone else? Okay, ahead, Chuck.
First, a minor point, and then a comment on expert panels. I'm not sure we need the word staff there. I have no problem with using staff evaluators myself, but I'm not sure we need to restrict ourselves to staff evaluators. If we decided or staff decided that to use somebody other than staff to do that, I think that'd be okay. The second thing, I'm not sure I agree with Robin that we won't need the use of expert panels. And it's going to depend somewhat on what we do in terms of implementation and some of the challenge processes and so forth. But whether they're called expert panels or some other kind of panel, I think the possibility may exist that those would be very useful, provided we provide those panels with objective criteria that they will use and that they're not just allowed to make up their own criteria.
Okay. Philip?
Yeah, as I said earlier, it certainly belongs in an implementation area. And I think, you know, I hope as council we're also going to see implementation proposals from staff coming back to us to say, look, this is how these things now look. Do you agree? And I think I'd really trust it to that process. But certainly this also came out of our discussion in recognizing there may be areas of expertise that ICANN staff currently have and there may be areas of expertise that they don't have, and therefore ICANN, in terms of implementation, has a choice, which is either to bring in-house that expertise or to go outside and find that expertise within
the
way.
And it does that currently in the technical area right now.
Exactly.
It has a standing technical committee that it can use.
Yeah.
For one of the.
But I don't think at this point we need to bind any hands in terms of how that implementation may look like. Let's wait for staff to make their proposals to us and then say, yes, that fulfills our wishes.
Bruce, can I get in the queue, please, Milwaukee?
Yeah, go ahead, Milwaukee.
Yes, I think I agree with what Sir Philip just said. And in fact, by moving the recommendation to implementation guidelines, I think most of the concern will be resolved, because with the implementation guideline, we'll be able to have more detail and about how this evaluation process will be handled. And in which case we might need expert panels or not. I think the expert panel is not foreseen as something systematic. But, you know, it will depend what are the issues and what we need to what the staff or I can need to determine about those applications. So by moving it to implementation principles or guidelines, we may have more satisfaction or more information to address some of the concerns.
Okay, thank you. So we'll do that. And I think a lot of this is going to come with flowcharts when we actually look at the implementation, because I think that's how we've discussed it, and I think that helps understand how it gets implemented. So, Liz, can you note recommendation 11 then drops us out of the recommendations and that kind of wording along the lines that people have discussed in the report?
Yep, no problem.
The next one is, again, a recommendation that hasn't changed, which is recommendation 12. Dispute resolution and challenge processes must be established prior to the start of the process, so that's pretty much what Ken was asking for. The recommendation 13 is applications must initially be assessed in rounds until the scale of demand is clear. And what the original recommendation was had a phrase that said, and there is a reduction to zero of applications for the same string. So that text was removed and it was just reads applications must initially be assessed in rounds until the scale of demand is clear. I think that's okay. Has anyone got any comments on that one? Okay. Recommendation 14. Okay, so I see you've removed the issue of contention for strings, have you, Liz? What have you done there? In the previous version, recommendation 14 was that if there's contention for strings, applicants may resolve contention and so on.
Yes, that was put into the implementation guidelines, Bruce. And remember, we did that in Lisbon, and we developed that flowchart which says contention between strings, is it an established institution, then deal with it this way. If it's not, then contention between strings goes through the process of applicants working it out themselves, unable to work it out themselves, submit themselves to comparative evaluation, or go down the option route. And that became an implementation issue.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that. I think we do need to have in our recommendation some statement about contention.
Okay.
And what the policy is for dealing with that.
Do you want to then put that as part of 12, because that's what that is?
No, it's... right, so you're saying dispute resolution includes contention for strings.
Yes, exactly. Dispute resolution between applicants.
Yes, okay. Maybe 12 could be dispute resolution... including disputes between applicants for the same string.
Yep.
I just want to make sure that people understand that needs to be dealt with. Okay.
Robin, can I just make a comment on the 12 and sort of the relationship that it has with 8? Something that just occurred to me is that we were concerned about needing there was some concern about needing a public opposition process in order to protect consumers from somebody registering a .bank that would just do fraud. But it strikes me that we take care of that here with this recommendation number 12, with this prior ability to challenge the challenge process. It seems like we could take care of that concern with this challenge process, and so we wouldn't necessarily need it again another time with the public opposition. So it's just sort of a little side comment there, but it just strikes me that we have that protection built in twice, and we maybe only need it once.
I think it's slightly different, actually. I interpret 12 as saying that it has to be established prior to the start of the process, whereas the what we're now calling 20 was actually an example of the things that we'll allow challenges for. But this is more about the process. 12 is more about the processes have to be established first, whereas the other recommendations are actually saying what are the grounds for dispute and what are the grounds for challenge processes.
And Bruce, can I comment on that, please?
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
Yes, maybe addressing partially Robin's concern or question. As Chuck said previously, not all the GTLDs will be targeting a specific community. So these two might be different or meaningfully different, because the now recommendation 20 will be addressing cases where the GTLD is meant to target a specific community, while the recommendation 12 is broader for all GTLD applications. Is that correct?
I think I'm interpreting 12 in the section of things that's a bit more about process. So we're saying that, like, if you look at 13, it says applications must be assessed in rounds until the scale of demand is clear. And then 12 is saying dispute resolution and challenge processes must be established prior to the start of the process. So both of those are things that we are directing, that the staff must have these things in place, prior to starting it. And it's separate to the fact that if I have a trademark, that's sort of under recommendation 3, or let's say it's infringing a legal right. So we have a dispute process that relates to infringing a legal right, and so that's what that 12 is, basically the process part of 2. Process part of recommendation 3.
Bruce, this is Chuck. Can I comment on that as well?
Yeah, go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, and I'm going to reinforce what you just said. As I recall, number 12, the real thrust of number 12 is to make sure that the dispute resolution and challenge processes are known
in advance
by all applicants in advance of ever applying.
Correct, yep.
And that's really important. That's the transparency. That's so that they can accurately assess. That's so that they can evaluate whether they want to submit an application, what the hassles may be, et cetera.
Yeah, and that's why I was saying I want to be very clear that we're defining how we're going to resolve contention up front as well, as
yep.
one of those.
Yeah.
Because the last thing you want to do is to say, you put in all this effort into an application, you find someone else has gone for the same string, and then suddenly into a completely different thing that, was never explained to you in advance.
Yep.
Bruce, this is Olaf. Just a
yeah, go ahead, Olaf.
Friendly amendment or a little concern, because it's a bit undefined prior to the start of the process. What process? And if you want to make that abundantly clear that it's the start of the application process, maybe we should put it there.
Yeah, the word application before process?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, if we can make that amendment.
Yep, got it.
All right. So okay, just continuing to move through these. So number 14 now is reading, the initial registry agreement term must be of a commercially reasonable length. So that was probably something we had before, wasn't it? That used to be recommendation 15. So the wording hasn't changed, it's just changed its number. Then the next one is there must be a renewal expectancy. That used to be recommendation 16, hasn't changed. Then registries must apply existing consensus policies and adopt new consensus policies as they are approved. A clear compliance and sanctions process must be set out in the base contract, which could lead to contract termination. If an applicant offers an IDN service, then ICANN's IDN guidelines must be followed.
Bruce, and back on 17, does compliance imply, or do we need explicitly to say, that the use of the domain must be in line with the application? I
think that's implied in compliance, yeah, but I think this comes down to we need to see a base contract to really know that. So I think the concept is that this is something that's partly come up from experience, I suppose, and in at least in the registrars there has been some concern that it's the compliance process is difficult in the sense that the only major mechanism is to terminate the agreement. There's not sort of intermediate steps. But that was just an example of something that there's a compliance process set out in advance in the agreement for how ICANN will make sure people comply with that agreement.
Because we're opening up a world where the opportunities for fraud will be far larger than they were before.
Yeah.
And compliance with the original intent is going to be a major issue.
Yeah. Is Dan Halloran still on the call?
Yes, I'm here, Bruce. But I understand that Alan is asking if ICANN should be policing the way registrants or the registry or registrars are using it, and not just...
No, I'm not asking. If it becomes clear for whatever, through whatever mechanism, that they are not, do we need to explicitly at this stage say that there is an expectation that they will be using the domain in line with the application? In other words, someone gets .bank for completely legitimate reasons and then starts using it in phishing attacks by creating subdomains, and the real world people have an expectation this really is a bank.
Dan, it's Marilyn. Bruce, can I speak on this topic?
Yeah, you can. Just let me make the comment that I think fundamentally what we need to see is a base contract, or at least a draft of it, to be able to have much of a discussion on this, because I think we're talking about concepts I think people understand, but until you see it in writing, it's hard to evaluate.
These things may already be in the sponsored contracts that I haven't looked at, so...
And that was the point I was going to make, and I just want to, Dan, I just want to note that I think that, in fact, it is ICANN's job and responsibility to police the contracts as they are defined, and I thought that was what Alan was asking.
I thought Alan was asking whether the contract has to include a requirement that the registry operator police the use of the domain to make sure it's in line with what the application said.
But that's what sponsored TLDs have to do.
But maybe Bruce and maybe we have a different understanding of what's going on here. I didn't think we were giving out sponsored TLDs here.
No, we're not.
We're using it as an example of a TLD focused on something.
So if I understand correctly,
what Alan's asking is if the purpose of the TLD is for the banking industry and instead it gets used for the gambling industry, would that be something that's covered by the contract? So if that's
or the fishing industry.
Yes, by the fishing industry. And I'll let you work out how that word's spelled. So what you would be suggesting then, Alan, is that in an application you say, I want .bank for, supporting the financial transaction industry or something, and you say that's your purpose, and you're suggesting that ICANN in its base contract makes that a contractual term, and so that if they're not using it for the finance industry, then they'd be in breach of their contract. Is that what you're saying, Alan?
Basically, what I was asking as a novice, do we need to specify that at this point in the recommendations, or is that implicit, and the contract will, of course, show it?
This is Robin. I'd like to get in the queue.
And I don't know the answer. I mean, if everyone believes it will have to be there in clear language, then we don't need to make it a recommendation. It will be obvious. If it's not clear, we should make it.
My understanding of where we were coming from in this recommendation, I think you're going down a line that we didn't really discuss.
Perhaps.
I think we were talking at a much higher level. We're just basically saying that we were thinking about situations where the DNS was not working all the time, or it was redirecting or doing something wrong, and there's some mechanism that you can terminate the contract. That was the kind of sense of the discussion, as I recall it. I don't believe we were getting into discussions of purpose.
Then maybe this is a case where we need a second paragraph refining the term compliance, because we are effectively directing staff on how to write the contract at this point.
No, but Alan, I think the understanding that this was talking about is that contracts basically set out an agreement between two parties, and the compliance and sanctions process is saying if one of those parties is not complying with that agreement, that there is some compliance process, which could be staff actually check to see that they're complying with the contract. So there is a compliance process for registrars at the moment. ICANN, does various things in that area. And there could also be some sanctions in the contract, which could be, some some things that happen to you short of having the contract terminated if you don't comply with the terms of that agreement. So that's what this one's about. This is not a recommendation about what the terms of the agreement are. It's basically talking about that there are some mechanisms to make sure whatever's in the agreement you comply with.
Okay. That makes sense. I guess all I'm saying is that somewhere in the overall process, we need to make sure that all these arcane rules we're putting together for getting an application through are relevant once the application is approved.
Right, and this is a point that Ken Stubbs made some time ago. He said that you can, if there isn't any compliance process, you'll state anything you'd like to get it approved.
Exactly.
And so, you know, there does need to be sort of a closure of that loop.
Yeah.
Robin, you were next in the queue?
I just wanted to, I'm not really sure what line we're going down, but I just wanted to express a little concern that if we're going to go down the line of not allowing businesses to innovate outside from their original application, I don't think that would be a good policy. I think that, you know, if you get the get a TLD for banking and you end up using it for real estate or for something, you know, or you get a TLD and you use it for something slightly different from what you had applied for, or even dramatically different. I don't think we should build in a policy that it should say you should lose that TLD. It strikes me that if you do something illegal, if you do engage in fraud, if that's the path you go down, then of course, you know, there's no, that's an easy one. But I want to make sure that we leave room for businesses to be able to innovate and to do something a little different and to expand their businesses. So I just wanted to express a little concern about the idea of limiting, of adding another paragraph in there.
Yeah, I think the other thing too is this, the more I'm thinking about it, it kind of follows on from Recommendation 16 as well. So Recommendation 16 says that registries must apply existing consensus policies and adopt new consensus policies as they are approved. And I think the discussion, you know, one of the reasons that next recommendation for the clear compliance and sanctions process must be set out, a lot of it was relating to that previous recommendation. In other words, there's some consensus policies or ICANN policies, using the more general term, and the registry must comply with those. So that was the kind of context.
And Bruce, can I add to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
And I think you've said this, but as I recall, the main thrust of this one is that there needed to be some progressive steps rather than an all or nothing approach. That was really,
and that's defined up front. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that was the intent. That's my understanding, yeah.
Bruce Phillip, I think you finished my speak.
Yeah, go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, okay. I think I share both the concerns Alan and Robin were raising, and I think perhaps we can easily square both of those. I think it should be the case, and I guess we'd all agree in that somewhere in the base contract is a statement that the way the TLD is immediately rolled out has to have a connection with the way the application is stated. It's similar to our recommendation 7 in terms of the technical capabilities for the registry operation for the purpose the application sets out. So I hope we would all agree with that. But I'd certainly support Robin's view that we don't, in that, want to make a completely iron wall and prevent subsequent innovation as the world outside changes. But I think that can fairly easily be captured by some intelligent language in the base contract, can't it?
This is Kurt. Can I be put in the queue?
Yeah, go ahead, Kurt.
I might be wrong, but I think the current FTLD contracts don't contain a provision like that about the purpose. What they do contain is a requirement that they follow the policy making of their sponsoring organization. So the way it operates is, or intended to operate, is the policy making organization is aligned with the purpose of the TLD. And so the expectation is that the policy making organization would continue with that purpose. But I don't think there's a requirement in the contract to follow a purpose. And my concern, I think, is that, you know, the enforcement of a provision like that will in some cases put ICANN in the position of, you know, controlling content or, you know, having a compliance program regarding content, which we think is outside our mission.
I understand that, Kurt, but how do you avoid the deceptive application? Let's use .bank again. Somebody goes for .bank and it's all to do with riverbanks, and they say it's nothing to do with finance, and the moment you award it, they set up everything to do with financial services. I think we need some ability to say, hey, that's not what we expected, and
otherwise the rest of what we're talking about is rather
hard. That's what makes this hard. I think there's some protection in the clause we looked at above about established institutions and communities. So if we were to look at a proposed string and...
Yeah, but nobody cries out because they're saying it's nothing to do with them. It's just a semantic equivalent. But the targeting looks different. It may not be as obvious as a bank. It may be the wrong example. But it's something that looks like it has nothing to do with a certain area, and suddenly, lo and behold, they're going for that, and it was a completely deceitful application.
Bruce, if I can jump in on that.
I think there's some, but not complete, protections afforded in the ability to object because there's a better representative of that group. I understand that this is the issue. I'm just stating the opposite.
But
that's it. Once ICANN gets in the position of content control, it becomes very problematic.
But the ability to object is during the application process, not once it's established.
That's correct. Yes.
Exactly.
Bruce, this is Russ here. If I can.
Yeah, go ahead, Russ.
I just wanted to point out that at least two of the previous successful applicants didn't launch as described in their proposal, and I'm sure that actually if we look more closely at a broader section of the application, that there were more like four or five or six applicants that didn't launch as described. But I really want to be careful that we allow for a great degree of flexibility as as the world changes, as the businesses evolve, as the namespace moves around, that we allow for that. And I'm not hearing that level of flexibility in what Philip is proposing.
The sorts of things I was thinking of, Ross, when we discussed this in one of the meetings, was not so much a case of what you must do, but what you must not do. So there may well be a dispute that's raised, let's say, let's say it was a trademark holder related one. So a trademark holder says, "I object because you're going to use this mark and you're going to sell X goods that are what I, sell with my goods."
Sure.
To resolve that dispute, you might have an undertaking that says, "I'm not going to use the mark in an infringing way." So in other words, I'm defining what I must not do. That doesn't mean I can't use the mark in a whole range of other ways, for example.
And I think with the way it's been handled in the past is that simply when a variance is detected, by staff or through the process, that it's been, there's been some sort of a public visibility process or public comment process around that. That may be indeed be a more effective way of actually dealing with what I think.
My concern was fully in support of allowing innovation and change, but also having a mechanism whereby if there is clear deception, we have some ability to come back and not, contract awarded, tough luck, we got away with it.
Yeah, Phil, deception is a tricky thing. So, I don't feel deceived by .name's representation of their email services around their launch application. I feel that they made that submission in good faith, and despite the fact they were not able to bring that product to bear, we found a solution that allowed them to launch their TLD.
Okay, well, that wasn't deception. That was changing to market conditions.
Is deception? Did they say all of these grand things to get the application? Did they say it in good faith and bad faith? Like, those are really tough things to measure after the fact, without some sort of damage occurring, right?
Perhaps they sent them just to get the application. I don't know, right? But I don't feel deceived around that. So I just want to make sure that we're careful around that stuff. That's all.
Can I comment here, Bruce?
Let me take a cue. Sounds like there's a few people in the list there. Alistair, anyone else?
Milwaukee,
anyone else? Okay, go ahead, Alistair.
It seems to me that the deception issue that Philip is raising,
I guess firstly there's the question of what is deception, but it seems to me that deception would be a problem if a candidate, say, for Dot Bank, said, are we going to set something up for the banking industry, and then basically just turned it into one great big phishing site and one great big phishing domain. So I would have thought that might be problematic if what they were doing was basically illegal. But I think any sort of it seems to me quite likely that a domain that sought to set itself up to conduct a particular sort of business suddenly found itself doing something quite different just through the sorts of people who decided, or sorts of entities that decided to use that domain, and they may not be being deceptive at all. That just may turn out to be, it's just a process of innovation. So I would have thought sort of deception might be a problem if that it was actually resulting in some sort of illegal conduct, and that would and something that may be something that might raise security and stability concerns, and if that were indeed the case, then that would be, I would have thought, within ICANN's ambit to address that.
Remember, illegal is defined by the country you're residing in, not necessarily the rest of the world.
Yeah, and I think the more important point there, though, is that we're talking about two sets of cases. One, which is very, very common, as our history has shown, which is that the reality of implementing the application is different from the theory of implementing the application, so therefore things will change. And then we've got this, what I would call a boundary case around what happens if somebody gets Dot Bank and sends up a bunch of phishing sites. I agree that we don't want to make it easy to allow the guilty operators to deceive the public, but we have no cases of that happening ever. So I just want to make sure that we ensure that we take care of the mainstream case and at the expense of that boundary case, and not vice versa.
This is Robin. Okay. Can I
get
you?
Sorry, who's that?
Robin.
Robin, okay, I'll add you after Milwaukee. Anyone else? Okay, go ahead, Milwaukee.
Yes, okay, so I am totally comfortable and agree with the initial interpretation of this recommendation. It's broader, it's more generic, and the purpose is not to define the terms of compliance and what the applicant should comply to. I'm not sure whether the council has any other opportunity to make inputs to the provisions of the base contract. Is that the case?
We haven't seen a base contract yet, no. The basis of the discussion, I believe, was it was in Wellington, where Dan took us through the Dot Jobs agreement, or it might have been Brussels, I get confused. But at some point we went through one of the agreements and looked at that, and that, the concept was that ICANN was moving towards a base contract anyway. But I've also said that I'd like to see the base contract for comment, certainly before it goes out for a final RFP.
Okay. The thing is, I'm not sure whether we need to address that concern, I think expressed by Alan, in this policy recommendation. But if we decide to go that route, I would agree that it's better to say what should not be done than what should be done. And we could word it if the applicants or the registry use the GTLD for purposes that alter or corrupt the initial purpose, then there should be some sanction process or compliance and sanction process. Other than that, I think we should open enough for innovation and evolution.
Okay. Robin.
It strikes me that this isn't a particularly unique question to this policy development process, because it would be no different for for new GTLDs as it is for any other domain name that's engaging in illegal activity or fraud or misleading the public. We have national laws that deal with that. If somebody sets up a website that purports to do one thing and then in fact actually engages in fraud or misleads the public in a deceptive trade practice, for example, the national laws deal with that. So I don't think that we need to create a policy specific to this situation. I think we might be overstepping a bit if we try to do that.
Okay. So what anyone else?
Me, Alan.
Yeah. Go ahead, Alan.
I guess I disagree with Robin. Local laws are not something that ICANN can necessarily use, and there's a long history of domain names that are misleading. I mean, there's a huge industry that assumes they exist. I think it is reasonable to somewhere in our statement say that there is an expectation that allowing for normal business innovation and evolution, that the TLD will be used, or perhaps initially used, for the purpose for which it was applied.
So
now, because you're saying we will have an opportunity to look at the contract and comment, but not necessarily to state it as a definitive recommendation, and therefore I think it belongs somewhere here. I mean, nothing we say is binding on ICANN. The board can change any of our recommendations before it's implemented. Nevertheless, I think this is our opportunity to say what we expect of this process. And to say that we expect the domain to be used for roughly the purpose for which it was we approved it, I think is something we should be doing. Otherwise, the rest of it's a farce.
Alan, this is Dan. I think I understand the question, and I don't know if everyone else is talking about the same question. If, let's say, somebody applies for .free speech and they want to have a domain for people to put in political speech and be able to complain about politics,
mm-hmm.
and somebody comes along and registers casino.free speech and starts offering a gambling site and poker on it,
mm-hmm.
The question is, would the registry operator be violating its contract there? Because if the domain isn't being used for the original purpose, and does ICANN staff have to field a complaint about casino.free speech and then go investigate whether or not this is a free speech site, in fact?
It's not the example I would have picked up, but it's an example. All right. What's the answer?
Well, what I suggest, because I think what I've been trying to do here is not sort of create recommendations out of thin air.
So that was my intent. I was trying to understand what the word compliance meant.
Yes, that's right. So I think I've clarified what the wording of that current recommendation
okay.
is. We're just going to sort of be wary of where we are in the process, so we're sort of almost 2 years into this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to consider something, but it needs to be sort of put forward and supported by constituencies and others before it ends up as a new recommendation on this list.
And it should be a separate recommendation from number 17.
Yeah, that's right. That 17 is just relating to the fact that you're complying with the terms of your agreement, and then what Alan's suggesting is he's suggesting a particular term go there, and that's fine. It's just that we need to get the wording right, and we need to get support from everyone that's okay with that wording. And trying to do that on the fly is probably not good. But if ALAC wants to sort of put something more structured together...
Bruce, I was hoping someone would point out it's covered in Recommendation X, or it doesn't need to be covered at all.
It's not covered at the moment. It's not covered as a policy... No, let me be clear.
There's a great big hole if it's covered.
Yeah. Okay?
Could I make a short comment, please?
Hey, Bruce, this is Ray. I just want to make a comment that I don't think this is a great big hole that's been discovered. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any other comments on these recommendations, then?
Yeah, Malaki.
Yeah, go ahead, Malaki.
Just to answer the question about casino that free speech. That's the kind of thing we need to avoid, the micromanagement. We can't go up that level to tell people to say this is not in compliance with the contract, and therefore I should take some sanction. The main thing should be that the other users should not corrupt or alter the initial purpose. The the registry and the GTRD to remain in use for the purposes that they have been issued, and then they can develop other activities if they want. That was my comment. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Bruce, I have a comment. Well, it's Adrian Kinderis here.
Yeah, go ahead, Andrew.
I know I'm an observer, but in reading through this document, I've just noticed that there seems to be a nomenclature issue with respect to the definitions. I've had a few times on this call reference to STLD, GTLD, new top-level domains, just to name a few. We seem to be using different terms for the same thing, and I think it may be a touch confusing, especially as it's not covered in the glossary as to what is a GTLD as such. It's not a CCTLD, and therefore there is no such. Yeah, if that is the case, then we shouldn't be using the terms of effectively STLDs anymore.
No, that's not part of the policy. It's just people tend to refer to past practices, and that's where that term is used, but it's not a term of the policy.
Is it worth adding to the glossary that hereforth GTLD is such and such?
It certainly is worth trying to. I think it might be in the full document somewhere, isn't it, Liz?
I'm looking at the full document now, and there's nothing. It says domain names, it says the term domain names in a Wikipedia reference, but there's actually nothing, no GTLD reference as such. Not that I can see.
Adrian, thank you very
yes.
much. I will make sure that's included. I'm pretty sure it's there somewhere because we've discussed it before. I think if you look in the section on Terra Reference 1, which was about whether to introduce new top-level domains, I actually included it in the narrative text there about what a GTLD actually was. But I'll just go through that in a second and make sure that it's there for you.
Yep.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Liz, you can make reference to the ICANN glossary as well because there is a definition.
Thanks, Olaf.
So just to sort of the final part of this meeting on the agenda is really next steps. So we've used this meeting to go through the recommendations, made some changes. Ultimately, though, we're going to need to vote on them. And I'm just, I guess the note that I put in the agenda was say, well, there's different ways we can go about this. We can ask council members to vote on the recommendations when they're amended as a whole. Or we can ask each council member to vote on each individual recommendation. Or we can separate recommendations into complete versus those that need further work. So from the mailing list discussions, I was getting the impression that people thought that it was okay to vote on the recommendations as a whole once we'd had a chance to go through and amend them and make any changes that people have requested. Are there any sort of further comments on this? I must admit, at about this point, I'd be handing the rest of this process over to Avery, but I do think we need to have some feel for how we draw this work to a close.
I think the approach you suggested, Bruce, is fine. We've got a little more work to do on a few of them. I think it will be very helpful in some of the recommendations that we discussed a lot today to get better understanding of the implementation guidelines, the process and so forth that staff has been working hard on. But once we do have that completed, I think that what you suggested is a very reasonable approach, and it avoids us backtracking and reopening things that we've spent days and days of work on over the last year and a half.
Okay, any other comments on that?
A bit of it, Bruce. Just to support that, I think we've already done some very good work today, which I hope has ironed out some of the issues that were raised on list. Also, just wanted to mention, I think you were working off an April document, weren't you?
No, the 10th of May.
10th of May. Okay, well, the document of 3rd of June also had recommendations 18 and 19 on it, which you didn't mention.
Yeah, okay.
Which I think again hadn't changed from earlier. What 18 was, if an applicant offers an IDN service and ICANN's IDN guidelines must be followed. and 19 was Redis is misused. I can't accredit Redis style.
Yeah, that's. Yeah, I thought I did actually read those. Maybe I read them in my head, but didn't read them out loud.
Okay.
But they're also in the 10th of May version.
Oh, fine. Okay, good. Yep. Well, just the record, then they're read, and I presume you're happy with that because there's no change.
And just one comment on 19, Bruce. It's possible, the registries and registrars are doing some talking on that particular one to deal with issues that we've talked about that I won't take time on right here. But should that happen, I don't see that as it's something that would be brought back to the full council, the full committee, and so forth. But just wanted to alert people that there's some discussions going on there.
Okay, thank you, Chuck. Milwaukee, yep.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure. Do you want us to decide now whether we'll be voting on the recommendation item by item, or?
Well, I was just trying to get some feedback, Milwaukee, and I'm not going to be driving the process from here on, but I just sort of wanted some feedback of whether. Finally, we do a vote by recommendation, or whether we vote on the recommendations as a whole. And the sense of the mailing list discussion I had was that there was a preference once we've done another iteration on improving them and addressing any major concerns people had, that we'd at least attempt to get a vote on the recommendations as a whole.
Yeah, what's the timeline of that final?
Okay, that's obviously the question I was going to ask.
Bruce here. I wonder if you wouldn't mind if I just popped in at this point, if you could, because I've got a suggestion about how you might wish to proceed, which might help everybody. I've been taking some detailed notes whilst everybody has been speaking and making the amendments in orange, which Chuck had asked for. I will be able to send that section out, which is only the recommendations. It is not the principles or the implementation guidelines. And I could send that around to everybody. What I did with the pro, and I think we did it in the RN group, what were you intending to have support by individual members of the committee, or were you wanting to coalesce it into a constituency position? That's the first question. If it was by individuals, then...
Let me be clear. It goes to a council vote. The council votes on it, and council members vote as council members.
Okay, that's fine.
Now, they may choose to vote in accordance with the wishes of their constituency, but council members vote as council members.
Right, okay, that's fine. Just so everyone's clear, because there's some new council members, particularly Adrian, coming on as well, so he needs to know what's going on. I can add, if you wish, in this document, a column that says, supported by, and people can begin to insert their names if they wish, and that might get the ball rolling in terms of establishing consensus around some things that don't have to be reopened. The reason why I'm asking for that is that whilst the recommendations remain fluid, it's very difficult to complete the final report, and it's very difficult to complete the final implementation guidelines, and we discussed this on Monday and Tuesday whilst we were in Maria del Rey. I would be very grateful, from my perspective, for the next version, of the updated version of the next report, which I anticipate having ready on Friday of next week, that we would move as quickly as possible to indications of support for either the package as a whole, and if anyone can say to me, I support the package as a whole, or I support 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 12, and the remaining work is on here, 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 and here, because that means I can close off particular sections of the report, and that would be a great benefit.
Okay, so let me suggest then that you separate that from a formal vote.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could certainly, as the staff policy officer, go and collect that input from the council members, and that can be fed through to the chair so that there's a sense of just how much support there is. But I suggest that, if possible, that the formal vote, which would be taken in a public meeting on the record, would hopefully be to vote on the package.
Yep. Got it. Thanks for that.
And now a suggestion, Bruce, in that regard, to simplify that, rather than making it an item-by-item issue, if I understood Liz correctly, it seems to me that it would be sufficient to just identify any of the recommendations that we believe still need a little more work. Then we separate those from all the rest, and Liz could conclude from that that everything else could be completed.
Thank you, Chuck. It's exactly right.
Yes, I'll support that also as a process going forward, because I think, as I said earlier, I mean, for instance, the BC will be unable to support recommendation one if we thought that every recommendation following it wasn't going to happen. So I think we need to do it in reverse. It makes much more sense.
Okay, so let's drive that in terms of collecting that data. But coming back to Milwaukee's question as to when, it would seem to me that so Liz will produce another version that will no doubt get discussed in San Juan. It would appear to me that it's probably premature to attempt to vote on it in San Juan. Is that people's feeling?
I think that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, this is Aubrey. I think we're going to have the complete report before people can actually vote for it.
Yeah.
We'll have to finish the process.
Yeah, Abby, I agree with you there. We need the text around the recommendations and the narrative and the discussion and the nuances of the debate, and that's what should come out on Friday of next week, so that people have enough time to consider that. But I would like to be able to release an updated version with some coalescing of support around particular things so that people can see, you know, because what we want to identify is drill right down to the last pieces of work that must be completed by a particular time after San Juan.
I think that's right. Also, I just want to be clear from a bylaws perspective, because there's sometimes a bit of different interpretations of this, that the council ultimately, whenever it does its actual vote, it's voting on the recommendations. The report in terms of the appendices and, you know, records of public comment, all that sort of stuff, that's actually the staff that produce that report and forward that onto the board as a board report. The council doesn't actually approve the report. The council is voting on the recommendations. Just want to make that distinction clear. It's a subtlety. If you read the bylaws, that's clear.
Can I make a comment, Malaki?
Yeah, go ahead, Malaki.
I totally agree with the approach of trying to lock in somehow the recommendations on which we don't need further work done and on which we are. That will be good for to make some progress with the rest. I'm just concerned if that was why I was asking the timeline question. At the end, we do have a full set of recommendations, with especially those heavily relying on implementation guidelines. I'm hoping that we'll have those guidelines enough documented in order to help us to make decisions about the recommendation themselves. Otherwise, it will be difficult to put all the recommendations together if some are still need some further work. Even on the guideline implementation guideline side, it will be difficult to ask people to vote on the recommendations as a whole.
Yeah, so basically the report needs to make very clear what the recommendations mean, essentially. And so, where people have added bits of clarification and stuff on this call, that's the sort of text that needs to go in the report.
And would the implementation guidelines be in the report also, or would that be
yeah,
the...
No, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So, Bruce, if I understood you correctly, we're hoping to be able to vote on this as a council in San Juan. Is that correct?
No. I think what I was saying, Chuck, is I think that's probably too early.
Oh, okay.
Just based on what I'm hearing in terms of...
Okay.
Yeah.
That's why I wanted to clarify. I think that it could be very realistic to do it in July.
Yes. I think I'd hope that, as I was saying, Chuck, I won't be here that time, but I would hope that the council would try and do that as an objective.
So do I.
Yeah, I was
okay. Good. All right. I think under any other business, the one comment I would add here is just with respect to the issues report that's been released on domain tasting. There's been a little bit of correspondence off list as to whether we can consider that in this call or not. It's clearly run out of time for this call. But it has been, in our last meeting, we did say that we would put it on the agenda for the meeting in San Juan. The one suggestion I would make, if there are constituencies or council members that feel that the usage report means that we should go ahead with a PDP, that you actually get together and try and draft the terms of reference in advance of actually voting on it. Because the key in these things is to get a good terms of reference, in other words, a good specification for exactly what policy work you're going to do. So rather than just vote and say, yeah, we agree to do policy work, I think it should be we agree to do policy work under this terms of reference. So it'd be good if some people give some thought to that between now and San Juan.
And Bruce, just one comment. I know what the bylaws say in Annex A with regard to timelines and so forth like that, and we all know that those need some revision. But once we decide to initiate a PDP, the clock starts, and so let's make sure we're ready when we do that, and I think that's a good thing to keep in mind so that we're not criticized all the more for missing deadlines.
That's right. And the other comment I would make is I noticed the staff report talked about doing some more fact-finding. You know, some of this relates to, I guess, GNSO review, but you know, the council could decide to actually commission some fact-finding and specify how they do that before actually going and starting the PDP.
Yeah, and
that's just another thing to think about.
Right, and after reviewing that report, the issues report in detail, I myself came to the conclusion that some of that fact-finding and research, not necessarily all of it, could be very helpful before actually formally starting the process. And I'm not suggesting dragging it out, but it could really help in the statement of work that you're talking about.
Chuck and Bruce, it's Alan. Just for my information, what clocks tick once the decision is made to start a PDP? There's a clock saying you have to make a decision within 15 days, in theory. I wasn't aware that there are other clocks which actually govern the following process.
Well, they never really have, Alan, governed it. But
they allegedly govern.
No, okay. The question is, what clocks that we have previously ignored are there?
Right. The PDP that we just spent all of this call work talking about, that we missed every time deadline in the PDP process. And I'm not saying that was bad. I think the work was done.
Just for my information, I haven't read the full PDP process.
Look at Annex A and the time frame.
All right.
Okay, well, at that point, I'll apologize as GNSO chair for missing every timeline and hope that we can do a better job.
Can I make a comment as you're closing the meeting?
And I want to
operate
if I can.
Okay. Go before me. I'd like to make a last comment as we close the meeting.
Just a procedural question about the constituency statements. We had June 7th as our due date for our constituency impact statements, and we had drafted ours based upon the May 10th recommendations, and it strikes me that based upon some of the conversations that we've had today and some of the changes that we've talked about today, that we may want to we need to rethink our constituency statement. So I'm wondering if will there be more can we have more time to do that?
Yes, Robin. Absolutely.
Okay.
Just do it because obviously today we've made a lot of progress on addressing the concerns that you and your constituency have
made.
Yeah,
if I turned in the one that today.
Yeah. Why don't you take the time that you need to address it. I have just been constructing an email for everybody, and I can pretty much turn around quickly the updated text which I've taken from today. And why don't you, as quickly as possible, please, it would be really helpful, get that back to me as soon as you can. And then the other thing is, those of you who haven't submitted the constituency impact statements, it would be great if I could have it as soon as possible.
Is it realistic to target 1 week for those?
For Robin, you mean?
For everybody.
No, today's the deadline, Chuck. Come on.
I understand, but you just gave more time. I'm a little
quickly as you can, it'd be great.
Liz, I'm concerned about leaving it wide open, and whenever you do that, things tend to drag.
I think it'd
be good if we set a specific date.
Chuck, I responded to both you and Mark McFadden today to say thank you for the constituency impact statements that you had sent me, to say that I would be using them in the quoting from them in the report. It's really important because if I want to get it out on Friday, an updated version, I'd like to have as much text from as many constituencies as possible. I would prefer, Robin, if it's doable, Wednesday close of business Brussels time would be the most useful thing, and then I can just leave a place marker in the document to include your commentary. if you can do it, then that will be great. Otherwise,
yeah,
that'll be no problem.
We've already done it. It just needs to be revised based upon today's comments.
Well, there we go. Wednesday close of business for anyone who hasn't submitted, but the sooner you have them, the better for me.
Thank you, Liz.
Thank you.
Can I make a comment, quick comment, just before the last one?
Yeah, go ahead, Malaki.
Yes, I just wanted to thank my colleague, council member, for the collaboration spirit of today's call. And I really appreciate that, and I appreciate the chair commitment to make this happen. If I upset some people lately on the list, I'm sorry about that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Marky. At that point, I'll now hand over to the new chair, Avery Doria.
Thank you. I just wanted to take this in the over, so I don't want to take a lot of time. I want to thank Bruce. I want to thank Bruce. Personally, I've been on the council about 2 years now. I've learned an immense amount from you, Bruce, and just the way you sort of led the pack of us, and I really want to thank you, and I want to make sure, I mean, I've said this to you personally, but I'm really hoping that you'll continue to be involved with the council as you become involved with the board, and to wish you the best of luck as a board member. And that's pretty much what I wanted to say.
And Aubrey, I think it would be good if we, as a council in San Juan, pass a formal motion of appreciation for all that Bruce has done.
I think that would be great, and if you want to help me write it, that would be fantastic.
Sure.
Okay. Great, and I really wanted to end with that, and thanks. So I guess that's the meeting at this point.
Thanks, everyone.
Well, bye, everybody.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.